So, Jeff and Defined Health and esteemed colleagues and friends, it's always great to be back. So I have, when we had our panel discussion, I asked to think where we're going to be in an N of one cancer therapeutic and sequencing world in 2025. And in fact, I know Alessandro on the panel is addressing that directly. So we have a great panel today. We have, from more the diagnostic viewpoint, we have Nathan Caffo from Presage, and we have Alessandro Cesano from NanoString, and from the academic viewpoint, I always call her my academic sister, my dear Roselle. She and I practice in a very similar manner, and I have our dear esteemed Jean-Francois Martini from Pfizer, who will tackle some of the regulatory aspects and also update us on the current global trials, national global trials. So these are slides, they're personal slides, and this is where I think that all of cancer is going. I have four basic principles on which we direct our therapies, and I'm just going to give you one quick patient example. So this is the classical hallmarks of cancer, Hanahan and Weinberg. I think the original version was 2001, was it, Jeff, something like that, and then updated more recently. But then came the whole concept in especially 2015 from Nelly Polyak's group that instead of a single cancer cell having each of these properties, rather, you have different clonal populations within the cell. So this purple one on the outside can be proliferation, the green one could be angiogenesis, the pale blue one can be invasion and metastasis. And these are clonal populations which all have dependence upon each other, and you will only destroy the cancer if you destroy that clonal dependence and each of those clones. And this is exactly the way that Roselle and I are practicing. The second thing is that you will have clonal drift. So as has been repeated something like 15 times in this conference, the cancer is clever and just keeps on moving. So everything we do is to anticipate this little red clone, which is going to evolve. So the question which I asked Charlie Rudin yesterday about whether we'll ever use dual ALK inhibitors together right up front in ALK-positive lung cancer, this shows a drift to this 1156 mutation, which is resistant to crizotinib and sensitive to lorlatinib, and then you have a further drift to this 1178 mutation, which is in fact sensitive to the de novo crizotinib. So surely it makes sense in this that we treat right up front with a combination and with of crizotinib and lorlatinib in the anticipation that you are going to go through this predictable mutational challenge. And Jeff Engelman and I and Bill Peters and I have had several conversations about doing this right up front. This is something which we do in our own clinic. If you have a melanoma, BRAF V600E, you can treat that with TRAM and DeBRAF. But René Bernaz has shown that for colorectal, when you have a BRAF V600E, you anticipate that you will have upregulation of EGFR. So we always combine the vemurafenib with cetuximab right in advance so that this bypass pathway is blocked. So that's principle number two. Number one, several clones which hold each of the hallmarks of cancer. Number two, you will have clonal drift. Number three is that, and Roselle will come much more onto this, DeVitra has pointed out, Siddhartha Mukherjee has pointed out, that there should be much more use of drugs off-label. The drugs, the targeted drugs, the immunotherapies are designed to tackle a specific biological facet. They're not designed for a particular tumor type. So we should be moving to a world where we do indeed approve drugs upon the molecular target for which they're designed, as opposed to in a particular tumoral context. And the fourth one, and this is horribly complex, but it's the nicest example I know. This is Connie Eaves, and what she did was she basically took some cells. These are basal cells and luminal progenitors. She did a KRAS G12C, whatever it was, transduction, and then she put these into mice, and then she looked both subrenally and subcutaneously, and then she looked at these at both 2 weeks and 8 weeks. And this is a critical Nature paper because it shows that the clonal populations that you had at the 8 week period were exactly replicated at the 2 week period. So clonal evolution happens much more rapidly than one would ever anticipate. The clonal evolution is just going so rapidly. And this is, in fact, one of the seminal papers just showing how rapidly it goes. So as a result of this, we treat extremely early. Rozelle and I try to get in neoadjuvantly, first-line metastatic, as soon as you can, because from this point on, the cancer only gets more complex. So what Rozelle and I do in our basic practices is based upon the way the tuberculosis was cured. This is Britain in the 1940s, a tuberculosis ward. It's based upon the way that AIDS was cured, basically. We all do effectively triple combinations. So I'm going to close out by just showing these are some of the triple combinations that we've given to some of our breast cancer patients. As you can see, these are triple-targeted or double-targeted, perhaps with one chemo line, trying to close down all of the drivers. And these are the breast cancer results that we've shown at ASCO, where we, in an average of fourth-line metastatic therapy, we have an overall response rate of 55%. So if you're very clever and you sequence each and every patient and you try to close down all the clonal drivers in that population, you will do well. So this is what it means in the real world. This is a 37-year-old girl who's got a couple of kids. She drives 4.5 hours each way to see us, and she had original ER-positive breast cancer 2011, went stage 4 in 2015, and she said, all I want is a few more years to see my daughter grow up. So she had a classical, if you look at this, just classical ER-positive alterations. She's got alterations in PIK3CA, CCND1, and she's got this FGF3/4/19. So as you are probably aware, CCND1 and FGFR3/4/19 all sit right next together on 11Q. So we gave a treatment of an aromatase inhibitor. She is ovarian suppressed with a PIK3CA. We used just everolimus just to block downstream with palbociclib. And in fact, on this regimen, she had complete disease resolution. The whole supraclavicular mass melted, all of the nodes melted. So the interesting thing now is we watch this clonal evolution by doing repeated circulating tumoral DNA. And the fascinating thing in this is that if you just look at this, she has an RB1 clone which is growing up. And this is a known resistance mechanism of the palbociclib. So as a result of that, we dropped the palbociclib, we put in pazopanib instead, and she now has a complete remission on the letrozole, everolimus, and pazopanib. She has no evidence of any disease. So this is the way that at least Rozelle and I feel that the practice of medicine is going. So without any further ado, we'll now move on to the diagnostic session. Alessandra Cesaro from NanoString will show a few slides.
Thank you very much for the opportunity of participating to this panel. So essentially the question that was given to the panel was how will new therapeutic entity to be developed and approved in 2015? And so because I'm one of the diagnostic person represented here, so I looked at it from a diagnostic perspective. And really all what was said during the last two I would say days here really, show and confirm that there have been really a dramatic increase in what we call biomarker-targeted drug development. And so starting from the early 90s, in which only 5% of the drugs were actually for targeted therapy, in 2013, 45% of the new approval were really for targeted therapy and intended targeting not only, molecular targeted, but targeted against particular pathways. pathway. And so my prediction is in 2025, the vast majority of the new approval will be for targeted therapy, single agent and in combination, including immunotherapy. And one of the recent article I read from Ford was actually saying that probably 60% of the drug for late-stage cancer will be essentially in immunotherapy. So what are the consequences of this? It seems that our evolving understanding of the biology that drives the disease directly or indirectly allowed really the cancer to develop, and that's include the immune component of that, will result in reconsideration of how cancer is really classified, and not like by tumor type or I would say tissue of origin, but by the molecular underpinning that is driving the disease and allowing the disease to spread. And so this will have important implications from cancer drug and diagnostic development, as well as regulatory approval, both of in terms of path and type of approvals, as well as coverage and reimbursement of the drug and the diagnostic. And so the implication for the clinical trial, really clearly the success of this framework, meaning characterize the tumor at the level of what drives the tumor or what allowed to grow, require what the diagnostic. And so it really require an having accurate and reproducible and clinically useful diagnostic that allow to identify the patient that can benefit from a particular therapy on combination. So that means really that from a strategic point of view, the biomarker strategy needs to become an integral part of the drug development, starting at the preclinical level and the clinical. There is an important to identify the biomarker platform that we will use for clinical trial early on, so that and in particular biomarker platform that allow for a continuum for moving from the preclinical to the clinical component will be extremely important. This means also that we need early collaboration and co-development with the pharma and the diagnostic. And that is extremely important because living on the diagnostic side of it, we experience this, the clinical trial design need to support both the drug and the device. And sometimes the support of the device is thought like a second thought, essentially, after the other one. So the biomarker-driven trial can be smaller in size, definitely can be shorter, can result in a bigger effect size, so supporting accelerated approval and short time to market. However, they are more complex because there are more parties involved, and that's true not only from the diagnostic and the pharma, but is also true from the regulatory point of view. So one thing that I just thought I would show is really that the complexity of the diagnostic, in particular the companion diagnostic, has increased over time. So if we are starting from just to look at the first companion diagnostic, we're essentially based on one test, looking at one analyte associated with one drug and indication. Herceptin was essentially the prototype, the poster child for that. But if you're looking over time, essentially the concept has evolved, and really we have seen, and that has been parallel to our improvement in technology platform and in understanding the biology of the drug, really has moved, has migrating to have one test, one drug, multiple indication, but also having actually one test, for instance, in the case of next-generation sequencing, like the most recent test, they are really looking at multiple gene, multiple variant, even if still associated with one drug and maybe one indication, like the foundation focus or the BRCA analysis. So these tests are much more complex than actually the one that we're focusing on protein. However, until now, really what has been approved as companion diagnostic has been tests that focus on protein and DNA, in particular mutation, fusion, and copy number. So my prediction is the next generation of companion diagnostic that will be based on next generation sequencing and gene expression profiling, they will be panels. And one of these is will be tests that will look one test, gene expression profiling with algorithm, looking at multiple indications and multiple drugs. Example of that are two that they are in development, are based on a nanostream platform, but really independent from the platform is the concept here. What they are looking is a characterized, in one case, tumor inflammation signature for the group of PD-L1, anti-PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitor, or the lymphoma subtyping test that is really looking at the characterization of the disease, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, looking at the cell of origin. So this will become, and they are phase 3 clinical trials, so they are going to reach the market. And I think the next level of complexity in the testing future will be when you have one test and you will have multiple variants, different genes, or multiple algorithms, all in one test, that really will allow you to guide therapy with different drugs that are applied to a particular disease, single agent or in combination. It may integrate multiple analytes. Information are not only in the DNA, in particular when we go to immunotherapy, but they are contained in protein and RNA. So if you can do it in a single platform, in a single sample, you essentially allow sample and time sparing. However, it definitely introduced challenges to the current companion diagnostic regulatory paradigm. And so I want to, everybody has spoken about immuno-oncology, so I'm going to leave it with that. This is really, in my opinion, an example of where we need different kind of biomarker, because immuno-oncology is a system biology work and is really required the measurement of different factors that are shaping the interaction between the tumor and the immune system. And so you need an integration of tumor, immune, environmental factor, and also different kind of analyses, each of which brings certain information. And so really the vision for 2025, for instance, immuno-oncology, will be the one of having tools here we can call it universal IO panel. Doesn't really matter which kind of analyte, could be RNA, DNA, could be a combination of that, but what really allows you is to have a characterization of the tumors independent from the cell of origin, but from their immunological posture. And this characterization provides actionable information on how, which drug to give and how to combine the drug, by distinguish if the tumor are inflamed and non-inflamed, by providing information in addition about the additional mechanism of tumor invasion that operate in these two big inflamed and non-inflamed distinction. So with that vision, I actually...
Excellent, Alessandro. Thank you. Nathan.
So thank you. Thank you, Brian, and thank you to Defined Health for inviting me to speak today. I'd like to present you with a fairly different perspective than what we've heard earlier, and I'm intentionally going to be a little bit controversial in some of my statements. It's late in the afternoon on the last day here, so I think we could all use a wake-up. So when one thinks of precision medicine, right, for the past 20 years, that's been exclusively one thing. It's been almost solely around genomics. This is a field I've worked in for that period of time. I was involved in genomics companies like Celera, Prolegen, Applied Biosystems, and so I'm pretty familiar with some of the progression that's been made in precision medicine around genomics, and applaud those efforts. But there are an entirely different class of precision medicine approaches that we're starting to see being integrated into clinical trials, and I wanted to provide you with a little bit of an overview of those. And so when you look at something that goes back even farther than genomics, a good example here is the Kirby-Bauer test, which is, I'd say, one of the earliest examples of precision medicine. And the thing that differentiates this from the genomic approach is rather obvious, in that you're actually directly measuring the response to a particular drug. And that's, I think, the key distinction. When we talk about functional diagnostics, what we're really referring to is not a static measure of, you know, what is the genomic state of a tumor and then making treatment decisions based on that, but how does a tumor, or in this case, how does an organism respond to perturbation? And so it's that response that we're really trying to measure directly. And so genomics, you know, again, this is not intended at all as a sort of a screed against genomics. It's quite valuable. And I think some of the things that people have come to really appreciate is how extraordinarily good it is in terms of the analytical validity. It's very straightforward to get this data, to generate this data once you have tissue. And it also, there is a pragmatic sort of almost philosophical appeal to it in that it's easy to sort of explain that, you know, it's the blueprint of life. It's the underlying code for biology, and therefore it's this sort of draw to genomics because of its sort of simplicity there. Again, the things that we've seen huge utility in is understanding basic cancer biology, creating new models of disease, and then there's obviously many examples where we've got now companion diagnostics. You know, most typically, those are things where you're looking at a variation in the target of the drug, and so they're fairly straightforward. They're not these really complex pictures. But there are some disadvantages, obviously, as well. One of them is the heterogeneity of disease, and as Brian just alluded to, you know, this is a rapidly evolving foe, cancer cells. And I think it's because you have this microevolutionary system with cancer, it's, I think, explains a little bit of why we're seeing this response when we treat with immuno-oncology agents, because you're sort of pitting one microevolutionary foe, cancer in this case, against another microevolutionary system, and that is the immune system. And so it's in those cases that I think we see these profound, durable responses. But again, the one thing that I think is most important to think about, again, I said this before, with genomics, is that it is sort of descriptive and static and doesn't at this point start to address heterogeneity of disease. The response to that I typically encounter is, well, you just sequence deeper. And do more coverage and deeper sequencing, and you'll get this greater understanding of the underpinning biology. And like I can tell you, when I was in marketing and applied biosystems and my friends at Illumina, that's like music to your ears, right, is just sequence more stuff. And so that's sort of the point here. As I go into some of the functional approaches, because that's really my intention. But that said, I do want to just highlight a couple of things about sort of where we focused efforts in this sort of single-minded focus on genomics. And again, what I'm advocating here, the message that I want to bring to you is just as you're developing drugs, to think about some of these breadth of new approaches. And it's not just our company that's doing this, but there are others that are as well, and sort of just broaden your thinking about this. So I'll be a little bit critical here, and I'll sort of stand under the cover of this quote from Disraeli that it's far easier to be critical than to be correct. So I'll take that as a buy. And you look at the amount of money that's being invested into genomics in the past few years, it's billions of dollars. And I know there's a good description of the economic benefit that's come out of that. Battelle did a study and showed that for basically every dollar that was invested by the government in this effort, that they got a return of $141 in return in economic benefit. And I was a direct recipient of some of that $141, and so I don't mean to criticize it. But when we start looking at the current state of affairs with exceptional responders and the idea of looking at whole exome sequencing and identifying, a single agent that then is going to treat an end-stage patient, I think we really have to question the return on that investment, really, because it's not an investment, a financial return that I'm talking about. It's a clinical return. And again, I'm not a clinician, so I'll defer to those who are experts. There was a reference made earlier today about this Cancer Commons or this CureUS exceptional responder project. There's only 51 cases listed there, and I know for certain after talking with Brian and Roselle that there's a view that there's far more patients like that are unreported. But if you look at that, the question that I would pose to you is sort of what's the denominator? David Solid earlier talked about 16,000 patients that were sequenced, and if you sort of do the math on that, if you took this as the sort of sole return. If you sent every one of those 16,000 patients to get a Foundation One panel, you'd be talking about, for each of these 51 patients, well north of $1 million per patient to get that sort of response. And certainly if it's, your father or yourself or your daughter, that money would absolutely seem worth it. But again, I'm just sort of arguing around the allocation of resources. So, again, it's not my intention to present a Jeremiah ad against genomics, but just to cause you to think a little bit about how broadly useful it actually is. So a couple of examples of this, one of my favorite, is something that's come out of Tony Letai's lab at Dana-Farber. And this is, again, takes the key attribute of functional diagnostics, and that is, how do cells respond to a perturbation? And so what they're doing is taking a biopsy, creating a single-cell suspension, and then exposing those cells directly to treatment. And then what they do is plate them out and expose them to these apoptotic proteins, these BH3 proteins. And they're basically seeing how close are the cells to being pushed into an apoptotic fate. How primed are they to be pushed into an apoptotic fate? And they refer to this as dynamic profiling because you're comparing sort of the response to a drug versus untreated and sort of measuring then how likely they are to get a response. And they've gotten some great predictive power out of this study that they've published, and I would point you to the Montero cell paper for a descriptor of that. Two key features of this, though, and they both relate to this idea of perturbation. One is that you've got cells that are live, right? So this is something that you're taking cells out of a biopsy, and all cells start off live upon biopsy. And they're doing this in a rapid way. So this is typically a 16-hour exposure to drugs and then almost an immediate read after that. So you're doing it in a time frame where you've got sort of the real tumor microenvironment still not totally lost, right? You've got real biology. And again, you're looking at, yes, thanks. So again, I think that's an interesting case, and we're seeing application of this both in solid tumors as well as in a number of hematological malignancies. So another approach that's been presented, and this we're involved in this. This was came out in a Science Translational Medicine paper, which described two different approaches. One on your left is one that came out of a collaboration between Third Rock, Bob Langer, and Jose Baselga. It was a very interesting approach called Kyber. And this is a case where they're directly implanting microdoses of several different agents into a patient's tumor and then resecting that mass and understanding what is the local response to that. And so there's some really interesting studies that are ongoing with that. I haven't seen any data published, and the company called Kyber has been completely in stealth mode, so not a lot is known about this at this time, but it's a very interesting approach. The part that's so critical about this is you basically have perfect fidelity of the tumor microenvironment. And then so our platform, which, again, you can read about in that Science Translational Medicine paper, and we have another paper coming out in Cancer Research this month, uses a microinjection device to microinject microdoses of 8 different agents, either single or combinations, directly into a superficially accessible tumor. It's then resected after about 24 hours, 48 hours, and then we do immunohistochemistry assessment of apoptotic markers and pharmacodynamic markers. Again, I would point you to some of the publications on that if you wanted to learn more. And I know I'm over my 1 minute, but so just very briefly, I want to describe how we're viewing these kinds of approaches being applied to clinical development, which is really what I'm focused on at Presage. So one of the things that I think is most exciting is the ability in the not-too-distant future here to be able to look at drugs and the response of single drugs and combinations very early in development, so early that we think that this could be done prior to a traditional IND. So FDA has issued this exploratory guidance document around exploratory INDs that allow you to administer microdoses of drugs with a very minimal toxicity package and much lower bar in terms of CMC control. So this would allow you about 18 months earlier than a traditional IND to be able to look at local biological responses. And so as one last example, just as a wrap up briefly here, one could imagine a systemic administration of a checkpoint inhibitor and then multiple different agents that are intended to perturb the local tumor microenvironment that are microinjected either with the Kyber platform or ours to then look at the local response. Do you increase TIL? Do you sort of turn hot your cold tumors hot? And again, doing that in a way that doesn't expose the patients to toxicity. So I'll close just by saying that precision medicine is founded on this idea that one drug isn't appropriate for all, doesn't fit all people. And I would argue that with precision medicine approaches too, one approach, a genomic approach, isn't the sort of panacea. And so for the work that all of you do here, I would just encourage you to sort of look more broadly, and I appreciate how much This is something that requires a collective effort. And so for that, I thank you, and thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you, Dave. Thank you. Lizelle, go next. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And so what I want to talk to you about is about customized combination therapy and overcoming the Lazarus syndrome challenge. And I sort of also want to address what Nathan said because we had a little discussion over lunch, and I love the functional assays, but I think he's really underestimating the power of the genomics. So what is the Lazarus syndrome? The Lazarus syndrome is, when somebody dies and you try to resuscitate them and it doesn't work, and then they have spontaneous resuscitation. And this has been talked about in the fields of genomics, where you have this patient who has really end-stage, heavily pretreated metastatic disease, and then you give them a BRAF inhibitor or something, and they have this great response, and then all the disease comes back. And so that's frustrating. So here, this is from a New England Journal of Medicine paper. I didn't write this, unfortunately, but was with the Hedgehog pathway inhibitor. It's a great example. So you don't have to be a physician to know that this PET scan, this patient has metastatic disease from top to toe, and then got the inhibitor, and boy, that patient had a great response, and then 6 months later, there, it's all back. So that's Lazarus syndrome. And then how do you overcome that, and why is this such a big problem? So what I want to talk to you about is that genomics has unveiled a new way of looking at cancers to us, but we haven't redesigned what we do for patients to be reconciled with what genomics is telling us, and I think that's our basic problem. So the fundamental premise, every metastatic tumor is both complex and unique, just like malignant snowflakes. Complexity and also distinctiveness, uniqueness, and that's the N of one of paradigm. So this is an example from a paper that we wrote with 75 breast cancers, and we did next-gen sequencing. This happened to be the Foundation Medicine assay, and I don't have room on the slide. I didn't have room for all 75 patients, just 13, but I think you'll get the idea. So these are the genomic alterations in each of these patients, and I think what you can see is that no two patients had the same genomic portfolio. And in fact, in the 75 patients, there was no two patients with the same genomic portfolio. So this speaks to us persisting with trying to treat patients in the same way. Now, about 15% of these patients, for instance, had a PIK3CA alteration. So if we do very advanced studies, what we consider very advanced, we'd put them all on a PIK3CA inhibitor because we found this commonality at the genomic level. But that's really not, that's a first step, but it's really not good enough, because even if those patients had PIK3CA in common, everything else about their genomic portfolio was different. So why would we expect them to all respond to the same drug? And especially, why would we ever expect them to respond to one drug when they have multiple genomic alterations? Obviously, this doesn't even make sense scientifically, and yet it's what we persist in doing. So let's talk about some of the problems that we have. The biggest problem, I think, with customized therapy is that people say, well, how can you put these drugs together? We never did a phase one study, and that must be very dangerous. So I want to point out to you that this is really a mentality, a cultural mentality in the oncology field, but that we actually treat people as individuals every day in the clinic. So here we have our genomic patient-centric idea. This patient one has aberrations A, B, and C, and patient two has aberrations A, E, and F. And the way we would do that is we would both give them drug A because they have that in common. And again, that doesn't make sense because they have other alterations and they're not in common. But giving them other customized combinations brings up the counter that maybe that's not safe just to throw drugs together. So I want to point out to you that we do this every day in the clinic, and we never question it. The average patient comes into the oncology clinic on 8 drugs. And so I'm going to give you another 2 patients that look just like the previous cancer patients, except these patients don't have cancer. Patient 1 has rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes mellitus, and congestive heart failure. And patient 2 has rheumatoid arthritis, depression, and hypertension. And we would never, ever think that we should just give them tofacitinib, which is a drug for rheumatoid arthritis, that's the one drug that we should give both patients, and that's it. No, we would give both patients exactly what they need. The first patient would get the drug for rheumatoid arthritis with a drug, digoxin, for congestive heart failure, and with a drug, let's say metformin, for diabetes mellitus. And the second patient would get the drug for rheumatoid arthritis together with a drug for depression and a drug for hypertension. And so I'd like to ask everybody to think about why we won't do that for cancer, because I don't think there's a really good answer. Probably it's a legacy of the cytotoxic area, where cytotoxics were very toxic to combine, but I don't think there's a really good answer for us now. And I just want to finish with the last slide. This is actually because this actually changed my thinking. This was a friend of mine that developed breast cancer, and she had our kids grew up together, and she developed metastatic breast cancer. And she was actually a physician. Her husband was a physician. And she was on T-DM1 because she had ERBB2 amplification. But then she was also discovered to have a PIK3CA alteration. And we made the suggestion that she should get everolimus with the T-DM1. And immediately the physicians came back and said, you can't do that because there's no phase 1 study that ever combined that. So that's not safe. But I want to point out that she was on another 15 drugs, because that's like typical for cancer patients. And so where is the safety data for the other 15 drugs, putting them together? Why couldn't we add everolimus when she was already on 15 drugs? And by the way, if she came in with an infection, I could add 2 antibiotics without thinking about it. And if she came in with rheumatoid arthritis, I could add a drug there. So I think we really have to rethink what we're doing here. And that was my main point. And for some reason, I can't get the slides to move on, but that's the last slide. So, where is the safety data for the other 15 drugs? And I'll finish there. Thank you.
Fantastic. And Jean-Francois will close out. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian, for the invitation and the organizers for giving me the occasion to talk about some of the current clinical trials, perspective on what is coming that's a little novel, and also give a little, counter thoughts about what was discussed yesterday and earlier today. So I will be presenting only pre-competitive information, even though I'm part of Pfizer. Those are trials that are not company-sponsored. They are sponsored by academia, national institutes. The first one is BelongMap, and this is a collaboration between multiple a national institution, some advocacy groups, Friends of Cancer Research, part of it, and pharma, of course, contributing drug and funding for this effort. This is a disease-specific umbrella protocol for squamous cell lung cancer for stage 4 disease. This was designed to be a phase 2-3 protocol with a potential registrational intent, which they had discussed right away with the FDA to get their buy-in as to what would be the endpoints that would allow them to move from phase 2 to phase 3 and get to potential registration. The randomization initially was done against standard of care, which was docetaxel, because we are looking at a second-line treatment for those patients. the screening was mainly genomic, again, with Foundation Medicine, and there was also one arm for which CMET was detected by IHC. Trial started in 2013. By 2016, as everybody knows, the second-line lung cancer landscape changed dramatically. It became unethical to give docetaxel to patients in second line. Everybody eventually had to turn to nivolumab, and a lot of those arms depicted here have shifted dramatically. The drugs were not compared anymore to a standard of care, but were looked at a single-arm treatment, and there was a another arm that was regrouping all the patients who did not have any of the depicted molecular alteration who received nivolumab. The second trial, which is somewhat similar but not quite the same, is the trial that is sponsored by Cancer Research UK, which is the National Lung Metrics Trial. There again, this is a disease-specific umbrella protocol, lung cancer. However, here it goes across all the histologies of lung cancer and looking at specific molecular cohorts that are not looking at just one alteration within the panel that's utilized, but multiple alterations to see what would be the best definition to identify the patient. And of course, the slide is not to be really read through in terms of what the cohorts are. It's published. You can very easily get the publication of Gary Middleton on this. However, compared to the previous trial, this trial was just a signal-finding study. It's a phase 2 trial looking at enrolling about 30 patients per arm. It has currently 8 drugs with 18 molecularly defined cohorts. The other interesting aspect of this trial is that instead of having a central testing, they trained 3 different hubs, technical hubs, that reproduced, quote-unquote, identically the same platform, which is based on NGS Illumina platform. And this way, they have a local testing, which is, quote-unquote, similar enough between the 3 hubs that they are similar to a central testing, which gives them a lot more dynamic in enrolling the patient, that actually this trial enrolled significantly faster than the LungMap trial. However, this is only in the UK and did not go across Europe. The other element here is that the platform utilized kept on changing pretty much every 6 months by addition and redesign of some of the probes utilized within the panel. The other trial that I'm going to mention is the NCI match. It was mentioned earlier this morning. This is very similar definition as a trial as the Matrix Lung trial. Here, however, this is not anymore a disease-specific. This is agnostic, signal-finding as well, phase 2 trial with no intention to register. The goal is really to find some signals of what would be the best definition of a molecular profile for any given tumor. And the platform utilized here is NGS with a Thermo Fisher platform. It has been evolving since 2013. A similar approach here, we have 4 different hubs that are performing the sequencing and the library preparation, but all on the same platform. And it opened in 2015 with 10 arms, and in 2016 it had already 24 arms, and since then, more recently, at the end of last year, we were already at 26. And the goal, again, is to enroll between 20 and 30 patients per arm, and it's only in the U.S. Then shifting on something a little more different, it's looking at the WIN consortium, WIN the trial. Here, we are not looking just at DNA analysis. Finally, there is looking at DNA and RNA, because DNA does not hold all the information that is required to perfectly profile the patient. In addition, not only did this platform look at both DNA and RNA, but started to compare between tumor tissue and the similar tissue but normal. So if you look at lung cancer patient, you would take healthy lung biopsy as well as a tumor biopsy just to compare the mRNA expression between the two different tissue. This trial has finished enrollment. It is not specifically a treatment trial. It is more an umbrella screening trial. The DNA sequencing was done on the Foundation Medicine platform. Affymetrix array was utilized for the RNA expression. Trial started in 2013, as I mentioned, finished enrollment last year, and we should hear very quickly this year of what the results are. The other added benefit of this trial is that it was a multinational study. So in contrast to the previous trial, this one was across the Atlantic with U.S., Canada, some sites in Europe, and as well as in Israel. And the last trial I will discuss here is the SPRING trial, again, from the WIN Consortium. This trial has not started. It is a true trial this time around. It's not only screening patients, but also treating the patients. The novelty beyond what was presented for the WINTHER trial looking at RNA and DNA expression, it is also this time around going to be testing triple therapies. So the patients will be really segmented very finely in a very refined manner to see what are the nodes that are truly activated within those tumors and try to bring the best three therapies together to test whether or not if you are able to block the main nodes within those tumors, you can improve significantly response rate as well as PFS. This is a phase 1-2 dose finding and signal finding study. The dose finding part will have about 30 patients. The signal finding study will have about 200 patients. And it is slotted to start in a few quarters, probably even next quarter. And this is also a mutational study. The one thing I want to point here is that even though those trials are very well refined, there is pretty much no real input from the patients. There is no collections of patient-reported outcome. There is no input of the patients in terms of how do you feel about those procedures, and we don't know how those patients will perceive their attractiveness to those trials. And I'll stop here.
Superb. Okay, great. So we started about 5 minutes late, so I'm going to allow Jeff, if it's okay, like 30 minutes for discussion. So I have 6 points myself to go through, and I'm going to be fairly provocative in these. So I'm going to pick up, first of all, Alessandro, on one of yours, because on your, I think it was your third slide, you had the rucaparib with Foundation Focus, and you had the cobas with EGFR. So will there be single companion diagnostics at all in 2025 or even in 2020, or is everything going to be based on a multi-analyte platform? Anyone can answer. Roselle, you seem to be wanting to go, so why don't you go?
Is this on? Can you hear me?
Yep.
I don't think single diagnostics are workable. I think that was apparent probably almost a decade ago, when that's all we had. It's a waste. It uses tissue unnecessarily. And besides that, a patient walks in. Which one of the single diagnostics would you like me to waste their tissue on?
Yep.
I don't know what's in their tumor, so it could be any one of 100 different alterations. I need a panel to figure that out. I can't do it one at a time.
Yep. I concur. I mean, I think just from the economic business case, it'd be pretty challenging to make a go of that unless you had a panel.
So I'm asking this very simply because, I mean, Foundation One is pursuing this model at the moment. I had an application from the West Coast this week for a single marker being prognostic in colorectal cancer. So I want just everyone out there in the industry, whatever, if you've got any opinions, go. Alessandro?
I really think the question is what is the regulatory path? And that is where, like, we have spent a lot of time since we have exactly the same kind of, although a different platform, but the same kind of vision that we want to have sample sparing. We want essentially to have the information from the sample that characterize the disease, not just for one drug,
yep,
but for actually guiding drug and combination. So essentially you need to talk with the agency and understanding what are their concerns in actually the regulatory process in validating not only analytically but also clinically this kind of assay.
We invited the FDA to this panel, but unfortunately they just...
Yes, it's also on the part of, diagnostic company of actually engaging them and forcing the issue. Essentially.
So number two, and I'm not just picking on you. You mentioned tumor inflammation signatures and a deep DLBCL signature or whatever. Will we have signatures at all in 2020?
Absolutely.
I mean, like we have signatures like Oncotype, Genomic Health. Will they exist in 2025?
Absolutely. Meaning we are actually have. I just mentioned these two signatures because I'm more familiar with them and I know where we are in the process. So these signatures are actually being translated in clinical trial assay, meaning in conversation with the agency, many conversations. They are going through an analytical validation, and they are now in clinical validations, meaning we use this signature to prospectively select patients that are part of registrational trials. So the thing is, if the drug fails, then we don't have them. But if the drugs succeed, we are actually co-developing them with the idea of filing a PMA.
And by we've got to be fairly quick on time. I'm going to be provocative. I'm not sure that we will. I do not believe any signatures. I do a lot of breast work for triple negative, ER positive, HER2 positive. I could not possibly see in 10 years' time there being any signatures in those diseases. I think, Alessandro, it's an intermediate phase, but I could easily be wrong. Who wants to argue?
I will. Oncotype DX.
That's the one I mentioned.
Well, it's there, and it exists for renal, for prostate, for breast cancer. Potentially, not yet, but potentially could be utilized actually to select and be utilized as a diagnostic for adjuvant treatment.
Yes, by the way, we have a similar test that is called Prosigna, and this actually is utilized to select patients. That is part of a trial that is going on with Medivation. It's a registrational trial, Medivation and Pfizer. There is the same algorithm of the 50 gene. It's actually the algorithm is used to select patients that with triple negative breast cancer that have a chance to respond to enzalutamide in the setting of triple negative. So, to be honest, this is the kind of discussion we have with the agency. I mean, when we go with the agency with the companion diagnostic, they are actually providing information on the data that they need. So if we provide the data and the drug perform in that particular selection, I don't see how it cannot be approved.
Okay. So as I said, I believe that these will continue on an intermediate basis. I don't believe they'll be there in 10 years' time. So that goes on to my third issue. All we're talking about is DNA. So except...
I'm talking about RNA.
RNA. So no one at this moment is talking about proteomic status, which is going to be big after the work done with Matt Ellis, on the Proteomic Cancer Consortium this year. No one's talking about glycosylation, epigenetics. Will IHC exist in 10 years' time? And will we be sequencing stroma? I mean, Morag Park produced a beautiful paper on sequencing stroma, showed it had different signatures. You've heard so much about stroma at this conference. What, Jean-Francois mentioned the fact that we're doing normal tumor in the spring trial. Where, surely what we're doing will be based upon different platforms.
Well, I actually, one of my comments was essentially that you can have one platform that actually is measured different analyze in a combination that is appropriate for the particular clinical question or biological question you're asking. So one of the things that, I'm sorry, I sound like an advertisement, but I think that is the vision, and so that's why we have adapted our platform to measure on the same sample protein, DNA, and RNA. The question is what to measure in the particular kind of context that allows, and where is the information in which of the analyte. But the idea in the future is to have one test in your sample. The
given. So remember, I've been pushing Joe Beecham to develop this for years.
Yeah.
Finally getting there now, so we're looking forward to that. Other comments, other people out there, any comments about where proteomics will be, like oscillation status, et cetera? So, Hale, have we got Mike? Jenny? Here we come.
So the panel talked a little bit about this in terms of companion diagnostics and now the complexity of these tests. I was curious to get the panel's thoughts on just, you know, what do they expect, in terms of regulation by the FDA, how that will, I mean, I know it's hard to predict given, obviously, the change in administration. The FDA obviously issued draft guidance a couple years ago, but now it's kind of on a hold pattern, but just curious to know how you envision that, whether that would play out nicely for diagnostic companies that are trying to get into this space, or if you think there could be a lot of challenges in the way.
I think that's to you. I'll just very, very briefly comment. So for our platform, we're actually not a diagnostics company. We are looking to get marketing approval for this, but really only for use in the context of clinical trials. We don't intend to have this as a companion diagnostic. In fact, we develop therapeutic assets as well. We have a CDK9 inhibitor that's going back into the clinic here shortly. So.
Well, all our experience is actually that the agency is extremely open to understanding this new technology platform, how we want to use, and they're trying to, you know, work with us in essentially making it happen. And all the conversation that we had, in particularly about really this concept of testing for multiple, characterizing the disease, and so not just looking one thing at a time. And essentially, as I say, they have a series of concern that this kind of new complexity is bringing, and they are trying to address. Controls are an example of that, as you will know, from the next generation sequencing and finding that. But gene expression profiling, in particular with algorithm, creates other kind of complexity. I think it's not going to be an easy change from one day to another, but our experience has been extremely positive. And we have a lot of interaction, as I just mentioned, three different companion diagnostics, so that's give you an idea, plus other, for instance, looking at different analytes in SMS. So
Sahel, I'm going to push it back at you. I know that, you know, your company has just developed a new pathology lab in North Carolina, so you obviously yourself don't believe that FISH and IHC are going away in the next 5 years, but will they be here in 10 years' time? Do you think we're going to be doing ER by IHC? Do you think we're going to be doing HER2 by FISH?
I think it really depends. I think the way things are going right now, right, you know, we still believe that there's a big need for them, and hence we're offering that as a service as well at Foundation Medicine. But in terms of 2025, 10 years from now, it just depends how much the next generation sequencing or other technologies that come along capture those elements. So if there's a technology out there, whether it be next generation or something else that captures it all in one test, then it may eliminate the need for things like IHC and other tests.
Okay, great. So
Yes, the agency even come out with follow-up. I think they call it a follow-on companion diagnostic because if you have a test that is associated as a companion diagnostic with a drug, you cannot just come with something else and just put it there without essentially making that a follow-on companion diagnostic. So they are even coming out with actually guidelines of what they require for that. So I think it's the word is not going fast there, but it's at least looking in there.
Brian, I'm going to jump in with something. Yeah. So we're talking a lot about late-stage processes here where, about regulatory approval and so on, and I'd just kick myself if I didn't acknowledge, I think, some of the work that you and Rizal do that is so much at the, pushing this to early stages. And, you know, I made a comment around disease heterogeneity and that was a big challenge with addressing, you know, to deploy genomics in that setting, especially in the context of combinations. But I think this is a place where, and Rizal and I were talking about this earlier, that if you go earlier and earlier in development, you're going to have a simpler problem to solve. You're not trying to, like, tackle and wrestle resistance to the ground with, you know, a whole slew of different drug combinations. So I think the work that you guys do there is pretty amazing and is, in large part, you know, outside of the regulatory context. There was a mention made yesterday about how, you know, it's no longer Sidney Farber sitting in the basement. Well, it kind of absolutely is. So thank you for that.
Yeah, well, we're trying to build this out to a network of eight or nine centers at the moment, so it won't be just Rizal and I. Rizal.
Yeah, so I think, thank you, Nathan. We had a great conversation over lunch. So I think that this, what Nathan just said, illustrates one of our big problems. I tried to address the problems of needing customized combinations. But the other problem is, are we treating patients at the right time? Because it's the right drug, and it's also the right time. So with targeted therapies, I think it's pretty clear that one drug doesn't get us very far. It does get us farther than I'm surprised how far it's gotten us, but we need to have combinations. But the other thing is relegating this to end-stage metastatic disease is obviously not the right place for it. If we're going to talk 10 years from now, I would imagine that every patient that walks in gets full genomics, full proteomics, full transcriptomic profiling at the time of diagnosis when the tumor is a tiny little thing, not when they have tumor from head to toe. And then we decide on the therapy right then based on a customized cocktail for that not as complicated disease, may not be complicated at all right at the time of diagnosis. I think moving earlier in the disease is critical for genomic guided therapy. Now, there's a little caveat here that I've been thinking about lately. For immunotherapy, I'm not sure that works. So every therapy, chemotherapy, genomically guided therapy, works better earlier in the disease. Now, what about immunotherapy? Immunotherapy, the more chaotic the genome, the better. The higher the tumor mutational burden, the better it is. It may be better for immunotherapy. That may be the therapy that is directed to patients with late-stage metastatic disease. I don't think anybody really knows yet how that will.
I think there's another.
Can I just ask because time is limited? I'm surprised how little emphasis direction there seems to be on stromal. Genotyping, proteomics, whatever, just really tackling that in this conference, Jeff, which is, you know, so devoted to immuno-oncology.
I would make one point, though, is going back to the IHC question, with the multiplex IHC platforms that are starting to come up online, definitely that's a question that is starting to be addressed.
Yeah, and this is something that we spend a lot of time looking at, investigating with our drug programs using our platform, and we found it to be of paramount importance. There's the traditional molecular responders and molecular non-responders, but then there's all this, my CSO has coined this phrase of structural non-responders. We published some data with Celgene, who's an investor in us, I should acknowledge, around Abraxane and some differential performance there of chromophore-formulated paclitaxel and the nab-paclitaxel formulation. So it's a big deal, but, you know, I don't know that sequencing germline variations is going to get you where you need to on that.
Okay. All right, two last areas. So your own area, Nathan, 2D and 3D assays. So You know, this is in many labs the holy grail. We're working with about three groups at the moment who are trying to do this. I've just had a fairly youngish person who had both PD-1 and PD-L1 altered on Foundation Medicine. They had distinct signatures everywhere of upregulated RAS-RAF/MEK/ERK signaling, treated them with a combination of trametinib and a PD-1 inhibitor, pembro, and just blasted straight through it. Could not believe it. So, I mean, your kind of assays would have been ideal in that kind of setting. Will it get there?
Yeah, that's our view, is that you would use genomics as a starting place to sort of winnow down to a manageable set. We do in our platform only 8 drugs or combinations at this point in the clinic. And I should acknowledge we've just started a sarcoma trial that just opened up, and we'll be dosing the first patient here very shortly. But so this is not something that's like in routine practice, but that's absolutely the sort of thing that we think adding a functional layer on top of that would be really important. Also, you know, when you start looking at checkpoint inhibitors, this is a case where, Rizal, the kind of work that you described where you're saying, you know, putting, you know, targeted therapy on top of escitalopram or something that's fairly benign compared to, you know, combinations of checkpoints. I mean, that's where the cocktails get pretty dicey. I mean, the combination of Ipi and Evo, 55% grade 3-4 toxicity, right? So it becomes the risk becomes a little bit higher to start to tinker there.
So just a disclosure on this, I am closely collaborating with each person on this panel. I may be provocative here, but I do love them all. So the big one, Jean-François, I'm going to come to you. So I what Rizal said, I think, crystallizes my own views, which is in 7 or 8 years' time, you're going to be having full transcriptomic, full proteomic, full, you know, everything done at diagnosis, and then you will treat with combinations of drugs. And as I said, I did invite the FDA here. I wanted Sean here to talk about how drug approval in N-of-1, but I'm afraid you're the person that's sitting here that has to answer this, Jean-François.
So in the N-of-1 era, we are not quite there yet, but I would say in the N-of-50, we are there. In monotherapy, when we have a true driver oncogen. So if we take the example of Zalcori, initially approved with large phase 2/3 clinical trial for ALK, the second approval of Zalcori for ROS1, which is a 1% of lung cancer patients, was based on a phase 1 50 patients. So, of course, there was this large database of safety around Zalcori, but I think that as we move forward with more targeted therapies for smaller patient populations that are really driven by a oncogen-addicted tumor, we will see more of those smaller trials with very defined population across multiple tumor types, which will be approved of 50 patients, yeah. Or even less, if those are really rare events.
So I completely agree. As I mentioned this morning, for instance, we're doing the LOXO trial, you know, for the NTRK fusions, and it's simple when you have, a dominant clonal population. But, like, if you take my lady, you know, and just do that as an example, 2 common pathways, one immuno, the other one RAS/RAF/MEK/ERK, and you now want to develop a RAS/RAF/MEK/ERK, MEK inhibitor, ERK inhibitor, and it will not work unless you hit the parallel pathway. How do you get the drug approved? And let me just quote, I truly believe this is why we do not have IGF-1 arm drugs on the market, because as soon as you give an IGFR, you automatically just upregulate MEK/ERK. So how would you get it approved in that? And then this gentleman.
So I would say that the approach that the WIN Consortium with the SPRING trial is utilizing, looking at multiple nodes and see what are the main nodes that need to be hit across multiple patients, I think you can build your cohort of patients who have not exactly the same genotype, but will have similar activation of major pathways in their tumor that you can come with your double or triple combination and get that to the FDA and say, this is the companion diagnostic or the selection criteria, and this is the combination?
I agree with that. Rizal, and then this gentleman.
Yeah, so I think that this brings up a very important point, which I tried to say a little bit about. I think we are at NF 50. In fact, we may be at NF 10. You know, imatinib was approved for hypereosinophilic syndrome. I think there were 7 patients. And for DFSP, the same thing. It's an amazing approvals. I also think that the FDA has been very progressive, amazing that I'm saying that, moving towards combination therapies. But where I think we can't get over the paradigms that we've created over 40 years is that we feel obligated to find commonalities between patients and put them on the same drugs. And initially, the commonality was based on tumor of origin, if it's breast or colon. Now the commonality is based on a genomic, you know, do they all have BRAF or something like that. But the science is telling us, what genomics has unveiled, is that each patient is different and that, therefore, each patient needs their own individualized therapy. And that is a leap to a different regulatory paradigm.
It is.
And I don't think anybody knows how that leap is going to occur. But I'm pretty sure the science can't change. So we're going to have to change.
We are.
Yeah.
So. Thank you.
So. Yeah, no, I think my point's being made, actually, after I was handed the microphone. But just to reiterate, the value of targeted therapies, I think there's a disconnect between when a drug is developed as a single agent, there's an arduous development process, and then it comes out with a large price tag. And based on what people can push back and say is a transient response. But on the other hand, it sounds like the diagnostics is well in front of the therapeutics, and for investigators or physician scientists like yourselves, who rely on as having as many different therapeutics to address what in their presence actionable mutations is predicated on the ability to have more of these targeted therapies out there. So it's not really, I guess it's more of a comment, but it does seem like there is a disconnect between the value when a drug is approved based on single agent data versus having more of these agents available in order to address each of these different mutations in a personalized manner.
Okay, great. So Jeff doesn't invite me back unless I close with something provocative. So will we have drugs in 2025, or will everything there be CRISPR and cell-based therapy-based? Well, it's coming rapidly. If you want a little bit of CRISPR therapy, you can go and get it in China now.
You know, I don't know the answer, but I do know that it's now become impossible to predict. Things are moving at such a rapid pace. So just a little example. About 3 or 4 years ago, when we would look at a genomic portfolio of a patient, and we would see that they had what we called total messed up genomics, lots and lots of alterations, we would sort of hang our heads and feel sorry for that patient. And the conclusion when we talked amongst ourselves was that that was the type of tumor that was too far gone and actually would never be treatable because it had too much wrong with it. And today, when we see that patient in our molecular tumor board, we are the most excited about that patient because that patient with that chaotic, messed up genome is going to have a great response to immunotherapy. And that's going to be the best response. That it will be the best responder of all. And so this was unpredictable 3 or 4 years ago. And so if you're going to go ahead 10 years, all I can say is I don't know that we can predict it anymore.
There's this quote that I love that says people can they chronically underestimate what they can get done in 10 years and overestimate what they can do in 6 months. So I'm hopeful we'll be making much more progress in 10 years than we thought possible.
But I mean, I must say that, you know, the way that Rizal and I are practicing at this moment, where we are using 3 to 4 drugs very early in the disease path genomically guided. We are getting excellent results. And when you pull some immuno into that, maybe, Jeff, when you pull some oncolytic viruses into this as well, and you get incredible control of the disease right in the front line, I'm not sure in that world how you bring new agents in. And there are still so many new agents. I mean, I have my little list on here. I can't treat my triple negative patients who have CCNE1 alterations at the moment, et cetera, et cetera. So I do think it's going to be hard. Any last question from the audience? It's 3:00. Any provocative points? I want to thank my panel. It's been absolutely great and survived my provocations. And thank you all. Pleasure.
Thank you.